Welcome to Full Prefrontal, the show that exposes the mysteries of executive functions. This show is a collection of conversations about the role of the prefrontal cortex, which impacts your focus, planning, problem solving, emotional balance, and independence. These conversations will introduce mental tools that will empower you to shift your mindset for a successful life. And now, here's your host, Sucheta Kamath.
Welcome back to Full Prefrontal, where we are exposing the mysteries of executive function. I am here with our host, Sucheta Kamath. Good morning, Sucheta. Always good to be with you. Looking forward to today's conversation. We're going to lead off by talking about gin, ginger, and ice, and parenting.
Well, thank you, Todd. Great to be with you. So let me start off with this. Have you ever met a depressed baby?
Actually, I have not.
Exactly. So by nature, babies have a happy disposition. You know, many cry when they are hungry, wet, or when they're tired. But baseline, all babies are happy and pleasant. And all that goes away when the baby starts growing up and enters childhood, so to speak. And even though it's extremely rewarding, raising children into well-adjusted adults is a monumental task. And the journey is quite arduous. Only a few know the tricks or secrets to produce the most well-adjusted human beings. And today, that's what we're going to talk about. So let me tell you about this gin, ginger, and ice story. I heard celebrated comedian and Mr. Showman himself, Martin Short, he just came out with his biography, I guess, very funny title, and talk about his childhood and specifically about his father. His father was Irish, originally from Ireland. He was a very successful executive in steel industry. They all grew up in, Martin Short grew up in Canada. And he talks about his dad having a bar in his office, but he was so disciplined that he didn't even ever touch it at work. But as soon as he got home, the dad would make himself a glass of gin, ginger, and ice. And that was just the beginning. Another tradition the dad had coming from Ireland was he ate a very large lunch and almost never dinner, and particularly never sat down at the dinner table with all his five children, but watched them eat. And of course, you know, Martin Short goes on describing the funny ways the dad would watch them eat and critique them and comment on their eating, comment on their behaviors. And I know Martin Short is making fun of this, but it sounds to me quite stressful. You know, if your dad sits and kind of is critical of what's going on of the household, it can be weird. So he says that, you know, my dad was sarcastic, critical, but right. And he said that, you know, the interactions with his dad or dad's interactions with the kids often bordered darkness. And so this just kind of how I want to weave this into our conversation today, that just because you're talented, successful, and a good person doesn't mean that you will become a good parent. Parenting is more about teaching, mentoring, and redirecting rather than just loving your children. On this podcast, Full Prefrontal, I'm talking all about executive function. And as everyone knows who listens to my podcast, that my interest is in gaining understanding and sharing knowledge about executive function in the developing brain and the factors that influence it. And the interactions with parents and the parents' interactions with their children is a very critical factor, in my opinion, that shapes children's behavior. It helps instill habits that eventually lead and promote to self-regulatory skills in the children. And that's, in fact, what a mature brain becomes expert at. But if the parents don't make it their business to instill these self-regulatory skills, it may not be part of the child's repertoire. So the brain's prefrontal system helps with focus, delaying gratification, organizing, planning, problem solving, and emotional regulation. And this is what, if not well developed, interferes with child's capacity to adjust and adapt to everyday expectations. So parents are actually very critical in promoting these skills, but they are the ones who are left to handle with these children who have underdeveloped self-redirection capacity. And these children become quite difficult or stuck, inflexible, or sometimes even unruly. So today, our guest is going to talk about that and kind of help parents expand their parental toolbox. And we're going to examine the fast forward, rewind, and the pause button on the parenting remote control. So that brings me to the introduction to our wonderful speaker. Her name is Christine Carter. She is the author of the best-selling books, The Sweet Spot, How to Achieve More by Doing Less, and Raising Happiness. And in this particular podcast, we're going to talk about her work that she, or rather her advice on parenting in the book, Raising Happiness. She is a sought-after keynote speaker and a coach. Dr. Carter writes an award-winning blog called Brave Over Perfect. She's a sociologist and a senior fellow at UC Berkeley's Greater Good Science Center, where she draws on scientific research to help people lead their most meaningful, joyful, and authentic lives. Her work is syndicated on Greater Good and Huffington Post, also psychology.com. Her work has earned her 2 nominations for American Psychological Association for Public Sociology and an award from the Council on Contemporary Families. So it's my great pleasure to introduce Dr. Christine Carter, and this conversation is going to be extremely valuable to those who are keenly interested in raising those happy, healthy, well-adjusted adults.
Well, we all feel that way. And so, yeah, I'm looking forward to this conversation. Promises to be very, very important. So let's get right to it. Here is Sujata's conversation with Dr. Christine Carter.
Welcome to the show, Christine. I'm so honored to have you.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
So let me start right away by telling you how impactful your book was for me when my children entered high school. So your first book, Raising Happiness, 10 Simple Steps for More Joyful Kids and Happier Parents, came right at the time when my son was in 10th grade. And so it was immensely helpful. And I love the way you have translated the research into bite-sized, power-packed nuggets of information that anyone can relate to, and most importantly, inculcate into their lives. So I want to center this conversation today about parenting, and particularly with the lens of executive function, that of the children as well as parents. So my first question is, when I think about executive function proficiency, I believe it's all about child's ability to self-regulate, and that the key ingredient for child's success is that self-regulation. And we know parents are thought to be a primary influence in formation of these skills. Do you mind reviewing the concept of self-regulation as you see it with respect to happiness or raising a happy and independent child? And what are some of the direct as well as indirect benefits of becoming a self-regulated young mind?
Yeah, well, the first thing that comes to mind is emotional intelligence, social and emotional intelligence, right? So the more that you're able to regulate yourself, I think with children, a lot of the time we're looking in particular at their emotions, right? Can they first of all know what it is that they're feeling in response to something that's happening in their environment? And then can they choose to respond appropriately to those emotions? You know, with kids and also sometimes with adults, we always say, you know, all emotions are okay, but the key is to know what it is that you're feeling so that the behavior that follows it is appropriate for the situation. All emotions are okay. All behaviors are not, actually. And so that regulation piece of things comes in being able to respond to our own emotions, and for kids, their own emotions, instead of just reacting in a way that may or may not be effective, may or may not help them out in that situation. Anyway, that's what comes to mind for me as the crux of it when I think about leading a meaningful and fulfilling and a happy life, right? Having those skills. But I don't know, were you thinking of something different?
So yes, I was also thinking, which is, I think you nailed it, from the development of that self-aware child is the one who is attuned with his emotionality as well as his goals and demands. So the second part that goes with the self-regulation is, am I goal-directed? You know, am I achieving the goals that I have set for myself? And what happens with most often, as you know, that they start off with maybe clarity or semi-clarity with the goals, but when they run into a roadblock, then there's an emotional dysregulation. And they not only lose themselves in that emotionality, but they have now lost sight of that big picture or the goal. And that I often see also derails them from staying or achieving happiness.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Before they even know why they're so unhappy or what's really going on. And that it comes back to the goal direction is really an important one when you think about how a response to a particular situation or circumstance or emotion is whether or not it's effective, right? Whether or not it
absolutely
helps you stay on track. If there's anything we know that it's that we will all face difficulty and yes. challenge, that things will not go as planned. And so,
and you do talk a lot. You talk a lot about that the modern environment itself is demanding multitasking, as well as there are stressors that cause this dysregulation as well, which kind of creates a sense of imbalance as well.
Yes.
So my next question is then, how do we discipline our children and eventually help them become more self-disciplined is one of the greatest challenges of parenting, the way I see it in 21st century. In my practice, yes. I often work with distracted, impulsive, unmotivated, and poorly self-regulated kids, as well as adolescents and adults. Mm-hmm. The story is as much about these kids as the parents, the way I see it. Many mm-hmm. parents are often inconsistent, unsure, and lose with their discipline tactics with their mm-hmm. children. And I feel there is a cultural shift in parenting where many struggle to know how to instill these cooperative behaviors in their children, become guides and mentors rather than dictators. And some, on the other hand, are afraid to lose respect or friendship from their children. So they just don't yes. know what the fine balance is. So could you tell us a little bit about how you have understood this through your research?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there's really a lot here to talk about, because you've hit on some things that I totally agree with. Culturally, we're seeing, you know, that there's both helicopter parenting, but then an unwillingness to provide the sort of the structure, I would say, maybe, you know, is another way of yes. looking at discipline. And that's the sort of willingness to say no and upset your children, you know, like not give them what they want, let them deal with pain and difficulty and disappointment, you know. So all these things that we as parents don't like to do. I think that the cultural thing, I mean, I can speak about this personally. I am a rather bossy person as a professional advice giver. And it's a real challenge, you know, when we're dealing with our children, to not just do everything for them, right? That it would be so much easier if I just did this for you, right? Like, but basically what that does is it creates a total lack of autonomy and inability to handle things themselves, right? So the end goal is that they will be self-disciplined. They will be able to motivate themselves towards their end goals. That they will be able to follow their own rules, basically, and the rules of the cultures that they and the society that they are living in. And the real challenge, as I see it as a parent, are to let kids really fail and make mistakes and let them be uncomfortable when we say no, or because they've made a mistake, so that they can learn the skills themselves, so that we're not always doing it for them. There's this big balance, right? There's this big balance between providing so much structure that you're basically doing everything for them, and then they're just lost. They don't learn the skills themselves. They wait for other people to do things for them and to be nagged and all those kinds of fun parenting experiences, and doing too little for them, so that then they just are out there flailing.
You're going to get a kick out of this. I began to reread the book as I was preparing for this interview, and my older son, who just graduated last year from Columbia, and now he's working for McKinsey, and I sent him an apology text saying that, "I am so sorry. I must have been really hard on you in the name of guiding you or dictating how you should take decisions. I really told myself that I was teaching you, but I was really being bossy." And you're so right that, you know, our personal tendencies and what the child needs, that sweet balance is something sometimes lost on parents, including myself, a professional.
Right. Yeah, well, me too, right? I've written a lot about this. You've thought about this a lot. That doesn't mean that we're able to do it perfectly. That in and of itself is an opportunity to model mistake making, right? Like, so this is how, yes. like, we do our best, right? That's a part of self-discipline. You do your best. You're really engaged. You do what you think is right. And then when you realize that it might not have been, you know, you might have made some different decisions once you learn something else, then you can self-correct, right? You develop self-awareness so that you know what you would do differently. And it's hard with parenting because we don't really get a second shot, but we can at least model for our kids, the way this goes, right? Writing your son that letter, how great for him to get. Because first of all, I'm sure you weren't that bad, right? But then he gets that and says, like, oh, that's so interesting. My mother is, you're modeling self-reflection, self-awareness, and the willingness to not always be right. You know, that's the difference between a dictator and an authoritative parent, right? A dictator is always right and never makes any mistakes and doesn't allow for any mistakes on anybody else's plate. It's just a completely unrealistic and very unhealthy position to be taking in your world. But you can be authoritative, right? You can be engaged and knowledgeable and do your best.
I love it, because in your book, you have talked about this as a firm and kind, you know, that being involved, exuding warmth, while you're also giving a very direct and focused feedback. You're also not reacting to misbehavior of a child, and you're not fake praising. I mean, I just love the way you had described it. You know, since that your book came out, I'm not sure if you're familiar with my two other guests on the show, Stephanie Carlson and Phil Zelazo from University of Minnesota, have done some work in very, very young parents, I mean, young children and their parents, in the area called autonomy supportive parenting.
Mm-hmm.
And you must be familiar with that. And so one slight difference that I see, that's even one step further from this authoritarian parenting, which is really focusing on that, how to help children adopt the student's perspective and welcoming students' thoughts, feelings, and actions, and commenting, you know, like you talk about in your book about that self-talk. And then parents are doing that parallel talk in My Speech and Language Pathology 101, you know. But I love that it's just a continuity, as you're mentioning, about really being modest as a parent.
Right. And I think it's also part of that modesty or the humility is recognizing, being aware of your own shortcomings to the extent that you can be, right? And recognizing what they are. And then I'm a big advocate of having sort of a go-to alternate response, right? So my instinct is always going to be, well, I hope I've gotten better, but it has tended to be to control, right? To direct, to give directions and to be like, I need you to do this right now, right? Instead of that, and that's not the best way to do it. I know this about myself. I know that my knee-jerk reaction is going to be to dictate a little bit. And so my backup plan, my sort of alternate go-to is when I notice that I'm doing that, is I say, what's your plan? Right? Like, so I just have a very simple question that gets me out of the dictating mode. So instead of saying, I need you to do X, Y, and Z right now, I say, what is your plan for doing X, Y, and Z? And
beautiful.
So it gets the kid, it gets back into that sort of autonomy supportive parenting to the extent that you're asking about the internal experience and the what they're thinking. It also, beautiful. You know, I have one of my kids had a pretty significant executive function delay. And
oh, really?
And she's a ninth grader now, and we're not seeing any real signs of it anymore. But one of the things that I learned about her when she was much younger was that when I would say, what's your plan? She had no plan. She could not envision the future. She was very happy and delighted to be totally present all the time, right? but that actually was a super hard question, right? So it made it a good question as well, because it identified the problem. Right. So I could just tell her what to do. Go, you know, I need you to get your books for piano. And I need you to get in the car. I could tell her really, really specifically what I needed. But because she had no vision of arriving at the piano lesson on time with everything that she needed, for example, it didn't, you know, there was a big gap there. And so sometimes when I could say, so what is your plan for getting to piano on time? It was a very honest answer. I have no plan, right? And so
yes.
Then I would have to paint the picture. Okay, you're arriving at piano. The lesson starts at 4. It takes 15 minutes to get there. You know, we'd go through the whole thing. Like, what do you have? And you know, at one point we actually took pictures of what her backpack looked like for each different occasion. You know what I mean? Like, I really had to help her paint that vision.
Exactly.
And sometimes with actual photographs, you know, so that she could sort of see what it was supposed to look like. Like, this is a kid who would walk out the door barefoot all the time, right? And, you know, like, she just didn't have that.
It's amazing how you have, like, really nailed it in my work, this concept of time traveling, you know, like your capacity to envision the future and you in it is a real skill. And it's on a developmental trajectory, it's something that emerges for those who are natural and intuitive with executive function. But for many, it eludes them. And in my work, I do something called Letter to the Future Self. Mm-hmm. So getting people, when I work in sessions with them, the cognitive training, we do this, I'm doing this for you. Oh, wait a minute, that's me? So my current me and my future me are two different people.
Right.
Kids head. Like Jerry Seinfeld talks about this, that, you know, my late night me completely screwed over the morning me.
Totally. Oh, so good.
So I think this idea of you're absolutely right that, you know, painting the picture, and some parents are like you, and all your examples are so candid and amazingly honest that you sound like you have a great balance in providing the support without really invading that, you know, you're not crafting success, you're just aiding or scaffolding. And that's the real challenge that a lot of parents don't know, but you describe it and people can learn it.
Yeah. And, you know, what I will say too is that these interventions work with kids. And an executive function delay is not, you know, fate. In terms of the whole rest of your life, you will not struggle necessarily the whole rest of your life. These things are skills that can be taught, even if they don't come naturally. It was much harder for my youngest to learn these things, but she learned them. She's doing great in high school, big public high school, and she's managing herself totally. And I know that that is because she worked so hard to overcome the issues that she did have earlier in her schoolwork.
Amazing. So let's talk about this issue of self-doubt. So feeling insecure or having self-doubt is natural human tendency, you agree. And a child's self-doubt may stem from ongoing failures or awareness of poorly mastered skills, or even negative feedback that the child gets from the environment. Parenting can be very tricky, as instead of focusing on those issues, a parent may be drawn into fixing the problem or bolstering the child's sense of self. And a lot of a poor parenting choice, at least I have witnessed in my practice, get made that way. So my question to you is, you do talk about, you know, raising materialistic children or children who are accidentally product of that environment, which they become materialistic or self-centered and not rooted in the right way when thinking about self and the needs. What suggestions do you have about supporting the self-doubt in a child, but not making it all about them and, you know, showcasing them as the, you know, main act?
Well, maybe you could give me a specific example, because, you know, I, what's coming to mind here is what we've already talked about a little bit in that, like, helping kids see where they have control over their learning and over their growth, right? So I think kids and people in general start to doubt themselves the most when they feel like they've been handed a label, or, you know, just sort of like, oh, you have a learning disability, or, you know, you have executive function delay, or these things that make them feel like, oh, I'm less than. And instead of saying, okay, well, you have this problem and we're going to go see this specialist and we're going to fix it for you, or we're going to figure out how to compensate in this, it's more like, oh, okay, well, this is, your brain works in a really interesting way. And these are the skills that are going to make you more effective, right? That are going to get you closer to your goals. So helping them understand what it is that they want and what their goals are so that they can be intrinsically motivated towards them. And then helping show them how they are in control of their own learning, their own growth. And, you know, basically what we're after is skill development. So if they're given a label, like something isn't going right, right? Like something isn't, that they have a weakness, that feels very out of their control and can be very demoralizing. And that self-doubt can become, you know, can spiral downward, can be a real self-fulfilling prophecy. But if you say, all right, so here are the three things that we can work on. And then you use that growth mindset praise to reinforce where they have control. So when, you know, my daughter would remember to put shoes on before walking out the door or whatever the case is, right? So we could say, oh, it worked to have your shoes by the door, right? That's something you chose to do, right? You remember, you know, you put your shoes by the door, you saw them, that visual cue, that worked. Good job, right? Like, this is working out. And as they get older, obviously the examples get much more complex and seem much more within their control. It's much more about like, okay, well, you did really well on the first segment of your math test. And that is because that is where you did the extra practice problems. So fantastic, right? Versus saying, okay, you got to do what happened here. You like looking for what went well and why it went well and how that piece of things was within their control. And then the rest of it as well, right? Like, okay, so you decided not to do the practice problems in these different units. How did that work out for you?
Beautiful. Right? You're giving parents these ideas how to break the process of giving feedback into smaller chunks. And then also, I love what you said, that reinforcing that aspect where they have control, they have exhibited control, they have succeeded with that control. And that can be a great, great tool. So my last question, I can't believe we are coming to the end of this discussion already. But so this is a little weird question. I serve in a very affluent part of my city. So as you can imagine, my clients and parents and children come from well-to-do families. They go to private schools and they have access to a lot of things. And so the question I have for you is, do grades matter? And how can parents create a culture at home that fosters hard work and effort without being too concerned with the results? How can parents calm themselves down in a competitive environment where they feel they have to stage their child's life by crafting scenarios or showcasing their talent? Many parents often tell me that, I don't mind taking it easy, Sucheta, but it's the other parents at my school who are tiger parents, and I can't keep, if I slip yes. away, then I can't, you know, my child won't have an opportunity to go to whatever school they want to go.
Right. Well, I'll tell you what, no, grades do not matter. What matters is learning. What matters is mastery. What matters is motivation. And if you keep your eye on what your child is learning, how motivated they are, how engagement matters more than anything, right? Like, what? Absolutely. So grades can be an indicator of mastery and learning and engagement. They can be. They are not always. And the trick or the mistake I think that affluent parents can make is by confusing the two things and pushing for grades and in so doing, breaking the motivational piece of things, breaking the engagement, breaking the learning. You know, the more a kid is pressured to achieve, to get good grades by their parents, the more likely it is that they will cheat. Cheating robs them of the learning component of it, right?
So
it's, grades are fine, whatever. They can be an indicator of success when it comes to motivation and learning and mastery and all those kinds of things. So I'm not saying don't look at your kids' grades. I'm saying that is by far not the important thing, right? What we want is why do we even want them to go to good schools? Well, because we want them to fulfill their potential as students and as learners so that during adolescence, their brains develop. I mean, it's such a rich and very, very important time for brain development, adolescence is. And so we want them engaged and you know, soaking up knowledge like a sponge and learning to think and learning how to think creatively, how to think analytically, how to trust their own intuition. If they leave high school or college with no intrinsic motivation, right, because they're used to being just ridden hard by their parents, right, and no sense of integrity in terms of their own learning, right, they're willing to cheat in order to just get the grade. And they don't know, you know, they're not going to know who they are and what they want. Because if you're not in touch with your own motivation, you don't know who you are. You don't know what you want. You know what your parents want for you. You know what your parents want you to be. But you can't possibly fulfill
that. Won't last.
It's a totally broken system then to end. You can go to the most competitive college that is out there that will give you, if you graduate, will give you sort of brand you as intelligent. But what good is that if you haven't learned how to think, if you haven't learned how to learn, if you don't know who you are and what you want, if you don't know how to motivate yourself, right? There, it is no surprise that slightly more than a quarter of kids who are going to elite colleges now take medication for depression and anxiety, right? These are not kids that are thriving. It is not, you know, going to a good school does not mean that you will lead a good life.
Exactly.
But learning how to think, learning how to be engaged, learning how to tap into your own intrinsic motivation, well, those are really good bets on leading that good, happy life. Those are great things for parents to be concerned about and be involved in.
Beautiful. So as I end this interview, let me ask you a corny question. What's the best parenting advice you ever received?
The best parenting advice that I ever received. Oh, boy.
Sorry, you don't have to answer at all.
It's such a good question, and it's like such a fun one to reflect on. And you know what immediately came to mind is a lot of bad advice that I've gotten.
I read about all that.
I know, right? Like my poor parents. You know, I actually had really great parents who led by example. And I think the sort of best parenting advice that I got was really indirect. And it was from my father, actually. He was a very engaged dad, and he's a very engaged grandfather, but he never lost himself to his job or his parenting, right? So as I was growing up and really starting to notice him, like when I was 10 or 12, and certainly as a teenager, I could see he had a job he loved. He worked with his father and his grandfather, and he loved his work and was very engaged in it. And he was home for dinner every night, right? Engaged. We would sit around the table talking.
Lovely.
And then he would go and he would volunteer after dinner. He loved to play the guitar. So he would practice his guitar. And then he would go play the guitar for a group of developmentally disabled adults that went to our church, right? So he just had this really full life. And I never felt shortchanged by it. And I think that as a woman, it was a really great model for me to have in my life, because I've never felt guilty about working, right? I've never felt like I couldn't have my own life and be a good mom and have a job.
Oh my God, that is so beautiful. So I get it. So your best parenting advice you ever got was to see how to be the best parent. Actually, you got to see it.
I got it indirectly, right? He didn't ever say, what you need to do is make sure you have your own life and that you have a good work life and you're really engaged and involved with your kids. He just did it.
Incredible.
And so I always knew it was possible.
Well, it is a true joy speaking with you, Christine, today. You are not only an amazing speaker, you're compassionate and you're kind and you're so generous with your time. And I am going to plug this book on our website so people have access to it. They must make a point to immediately start reading, even if they don't have children, because they can eventually become very good mentors to all the young children who are growing up in this world. So thank you for coming on the show and giving us your time and shedding light on these very difficult concepts that are much easily understood if an expert is doing it. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Well, that was Sucheda and Dr. Christine Carter. Wow, Sucheda, what an impactful conversation. Lots to think here. Lead us off with some initial thoughts, please.
Sure. Thank you so much, Todd. So let's start with the big picture. In my conversation with Dr. Carter, we really focused on defining and finding ways to meet the end goal in parenting. And I kind of led us off by saying that, you know, happy, well-adjusted individuals is what we are hoping for. So what is the end goal? It is to raise self-sufficient, independent, and happy children. And if we dissect that further, here's what we get. So self-sufficient means kids who know how to set goals for themselves, prioritize steps, make plans, and put those plans into motion by themselves. So let's look at the second component, which is independent. What does independent mean? Free from outside support, guidance, or interference, without any help from others, and do it not just once, but always. So it's not once that you do something independently, but always you continue to do independently. And what you are pursuing independently constantly changes. And finally, every parent wants their child to be happy. So if you ask me, In fact, I have said that quite often in my talks, that happiness is a myth. Rather than focusing on happy children, we need to really understand that happy children means children who have a hold on their emotions, children who have strong emotional life, but they have developed the skill set that allows them to shift their mood, attitude, and mindset from negative state into the positive state. And not just once, but always. So all these three things that I just described is what the parenting end goal is. And that's why parenting is so tricky. That's what I got out of this, that it's easy to get drawn into fixing the problem of the child or problem raising children that parents encounter as an adult. Just do it and take care of it. And it's very tempting to do everything to bolster the child's sense of self-worth. But to do it differently, it really is a hard matter, isn't it?
Yeah, that's so true. I mean, the world's a tricky place, right? And we're going to have setbacks. We're going to have failures. And you just have to learn how to emotionally deal with that. I mean, you just can't fix everything. That's such a profound statement about how we're parenting today. Fascinating. All right. So do this for us then. So how should parents rework their thinking about raising happy and well-adjusted independent kids?
Well, thank you for that question. I think that's my second takeaway, that I like to, in my practice, often refer to something called golden standard. So to me, I think there needs to be rework done by parenting, by parents externalizing their golden standard to their children. Having a golden standard is one thing, but explicitly making it available to the children and making it a priority that children understand and have a buy-in to that golden standard. So for starters, parents can do a quick self-check and see if they have created a household where the children know that having emotions is okay, but not all behaviors that emerge because of those emotions are okay. And this is such a distinct thing that our discussions kind of focused on, that, you know, being emotional or being frustrated, angry, upset, peeved, annoyed is fine. That's just what being a human looks like. But just because you're angry, you throw a remote control at your brother. You know, just because you're frustrated, you tear the homework page. Those behaviors are not acceptable. And I think often parents kind of get carried away in focusing on the behaviors that are not appropriate rather than the emotions that cause these behaviors. Another way to think about this is to help children respond rather than react. And children do well if they have a role model and if the parents themselves have consistently modeled this way of behaving. And it's one thing, you know, that parents say, calm down, don't throw a tantrum. But then the child watches the parent in the car honking, you know, very impatiently, or slamming doors when somebody says, no, we have run out of something, or yelling at the waiter when the waiter brings the wrong order. So you really can't demand something from your children or expect that if you yourself haven't regulated your own emotions and your behaviors that emerge because of your emotions yourself, you haven't understood the disconnect there. Also, if a child grows up watching parents, you know, slamming doors and having a fight and becoming upset and screaming and using over the top gestures and disagreeing in every possible way, that child picks up on that as if that's the golden standard. And you, as I earlier mentioned, that your verbal guidance, but if it contradicts with your behaviors, then the child is going to follow the behaviors, not the verbal guidance. So what in fact needs to happen is parents need to focus on raising emotional acumen of their children. And this can be done in two distinct ways. One is to help the child identify and label those feelings. And second is to teach the child the difference between reacting versus responding. And then, of course, walking the child through the process of responding appropriately. Now, as I end with this second takeaway, busy lives and digitally wired modern environment can pose a challenge for all families, parents and children alike. So because of that, it takes time and requires uninterrupted attention. This can be a hard, monumental task and monumental goal to achieve. But this is what I feel, like I always give this analogy to parents, that if you have a flat tire, you pull over and you put a replacement tire. And then you take a road trip to Florida, let's say, you know, which takes 800 miles. No, what's the advice? That you do not ride a long distance with a replacement tire. It's a temporary tire. So So taking time during this crisis, during crisis, just handle the crisis, but then pull away and set aside certain time to address more underlying behaviors that are consistently appearing in child-parent interactions, and that can lead to greater success.
Mm. Thinking about what you just said, I imagine there's a lot of people out there operating with spare tires. That's such a great analogy. So, all right. Well, I heard Dr. Carter talk about rethinking one's own approach with their children, right?
Yeah. So that again, so there is a belief about, you know, what child does or your, and then that's belief about what I do as a parent, you know? So I believe that reinventing parenting is reprogramming one's own belief. And what is this belief that needs great attention is, you know, accepting things. So the secret lies in how the parents come to accept that he or she may not be right all the time or right most of the time. That can be very painful to accept that you may not be right. And, you know, I've seen that with my own children, even simple things as math, you know, parents often talk about that, you know, I do it this way. And then, you know, your third grader is arguing, no, but Mrs. Smith doesn't want me to carry over. She wants me to use this technique. And so this is easy to deal with because you're saying my approach and teacher's approach. But what if you were wrong in the way you helped your child? There's no like a, you know, book to refer to. It's basically your child points out that you did this and that was wrong. And a lot of parents have difficulty accepting that. Secondly, is that parent withstand, can you as a parent withstand the pain of witnessing the child having or going through difficulties? And to bear witness to this discomfort the child feels is in fact provokes anxiety, you know, creates stress, and can be nerve-wracking obstacle in thinking clearly about solutions. So it's watching your own emotions and watching your emotions as the child is having an emotional breakdown can be really hard. The parenting golden rule, as I was talking about, then ultimately comes down to the balancing act, you know, guiding appropriately while holding back when it comes to preventing failures is the true success. That's the secret sauce. So you must guide and not, your children are not going to come to you for guidance. So you need to say, this is my time to guide you. And there are certain failures that are essential. But as you watch them fail, you don't need to make it an epic fail. That's another important thing to think about. So most important thing here, last component about this third takeaway, is that you don't need to give a vibe of complete abandonment as you witness the discomfort of a child having a unbelievable failure. But what you need to say, I'm right here. I'm right here as I watch you. It's like your child is, you know, in gymnastics and she's on this, you know, bar and then she's doing the balancing act and she falls and she, you know, hurts her leg. You can't suddenly say, now let me, instead of you, get on that bar and do it. First of all, you can't do it. But secondly, that's not what being in gymnastics means. It actually means you need to learn to patiently watch her fall. And that can be a painful process. But when done well, you can always say, I love the way you got up. I love the way you kind of found out how to take away the pressure on your left leg. You know, you're pointing out the resiliency to the child.
Mm. Lots to think about there. Great stuff. So, Jada, any final thoughts before we wrap this conversation?
Sure, Todd. So, you know, this whole discussion about parenting made me think about this question. You know, can we elevate the lives of our children? Can we be responsible for their greatness? I'll share something Dr. Carter has talked about in her book, Raising Happiness, which did not come up in our discussion because of the, you know, short time that I had with her. But she talked about people who rise to greatness have five things in common. You know, the first thing, they practice hard. Second thing, they practice consistently. Third is they gain experience over a long haul. That means they put in the time that goes into gaining that practice. Fourth is that they have passion. They possess the passion to stick with things, and they are quite consistent with that, whether good, bad, or ugly, that their effort leads to results or not. And the last one is they have an experience of epic failure. And exactly what parents try to avoid, right? Parents find it really difficult to allow their children a habit of doing something again and again, particularly if it's hard. And take example of making bed. You know, when my kids were younger, they may not remember this, but I used to supervise making bed. I mean, I grew up in India, you know, making bed to my family was symbolic of your entire commitment to taking care of self. And so that kind of carried over with me. And I would watch them, you know, and I would watch them first, you know, put the pillow, then pull the sheet and pull the covers. And it doesn't need to be perfect. You know, there are some points you can think about that, you know, edges of the comforter can be hanging equally or whatever. It sounds ridiculous. And most people have said that to me, like, why put so much effort in making bed? But I found that once you kind of make it your business that this is important to us as a family, then the same effort went into packing the bag for school. Same effort went into packing the soccer bag for soccer. And then musical instrument. And then eventually when it came to traveling abroad for, you know, my son went to France and he packed all his bag by himself, which was by eighth grade, you know, end of eighth grade. So these are the steps that lead to this kind of greatness, but it comes from managing expectations and drawing out child's potential by parent exercising leadership and mentorship. And that's what the parenting balancing look like. So in closing, I want to say that parents need to stay clear from the pitfalls of high and erroneous expectations or expectations of performance or lack of support and consistent supervision and guidance. Just because you have great expectations and you tell your child about the expectations doesn't mean that will translate into a behavior and being. Executive function or self-regulation emerge, and these skills kind of lie in between these set of abilities and inabilities, and they don't need to become diagnosable entity, but all the beginning is rough. You know, it's riddled with inattention, lack of motivation, lack of cooperation with the parents, not wanting to work harder than needed. Those are kind of things are inherent to being a child. And parents need to create a culture and instill a value in hard work and make it a mental habit to always face failure first and give that negative feedback, which is inevitable building block of successful mindset. And so all that, when done well, ultimately becomes leads to this happy, well-adjusted, and responsible and independent child. So there is a lot parents can do, and I hope parents take that seriously, which I think they do, but just by taking seriously doesn't mean they will become the doer of this mentorship. So I hope parents become mentors.
Mm, what a great way to close that. Such important stuff. And I will have to be honest, Sucheta, I'm in my upper 40s and I still don't do a very good job making my bed. So you would have not liked raising me as a child, I'll assure you of that. All right. Well, what a great conversation. That's all the time we have for today. On behalf of our host, Sucheta Kamath, and all of us at Cerebral Matters, thank you for tuning in and listening. And we look forward to seeing you again next week for Sucheta's second conversation with Dr. Christine Carter. We'll see you then.
Thank you for listening to Full Prefrontal, exposing the mysteries of executive functions. To contact our host, Sucheta Kamath, and learn more about her work on improving executive functions, visit her website at CerebralMatters.com. That's CerebralMatters.com. Tune in next week for the next informative episode of Full Prefrontal.